Well, welcome to Trinity. We're glad you are here, and glad to have the opportunity to open up God's Word with you this morning and see what He has for us. I want you to take a minute and think back to your first ever dance. Yeah, right? Yeah, think back to that, for your first ever dance, wherever that was. I remember mine well. It was in the gymnasium of Carter Junior High, and it was an incredibly, I would love to say it was a wonderful time. It was an incredibly awkward time. All the guys were congregated on one wall. All the girls were standing on another wall, looking at the guys with either anger or longing. Like, one of you guys walk out here and do something. And eventually, one of the guys made a move. And the rest of us pulled back in both fear and envy, right? Thinking, what's going to happen? Will he come back alive? And he did. He survived, and a few others, brave souls, made it. And most of the other guys stood against the wall for the remainder of the evening, wanting to move but not moving. Right. And if you compare all of that, your first dance experience, with watching a couple that really knows how to dance well, you know, a couple that knows how to dance well together is a beautiful thing. They flow together. There's amazing creativity as they kind of move in and out of various dance steps. It looks fluid and planned, and yet it looks incredibly creative and dynamic. And there's an ease in the way that a couple who knows how to dance together well that moves. And generally speaking, the man leads and the woman follows, and there's a response, and it's just a cooperative, beautiful thing. And the picture of a dance may be the best image of what a good marriage looks like. It's two individuals weaving together into a life that flows together, that is creative together, that is responsive together. And so this morning I want to kind of use that image as we get started of what a marriage looks like. Now, unfortunately, many of us dance either like Elaine Bettis, you know, or we dance like, you know, one of the worst contestants on Dancing with the Stars. It's just an uncoordinated mess. But this morning, what I want to do is try to talk and give you some helpful thoughts on marriage out of Ephesians 5. Before we do that, let's pray. Let's take a moment and ask God to speak to us this morning. Father, you created marriage, and you have much to say about it. Lord, I know as we talk about marriage, it's kind of like that first dance where it creates both longing and fear. It surfaces a wide range of emotions in all of us. And Lord, I pray that, you know, Jesus said, you said that the truth will set us free. And I do pray today as we look into your truth that it would indeed set us free and that we would dance better. So Lord, we pray these things in your name. Amen. All right, we're going to look at Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5, I really do believe the verses 21 to 33, if you really soaked yourself in that, I think it tells you just about everything you need to know for a good marriage. It really does. This is the foundation of everything you need to know. And we could spend literally weeks and weeks and weeks working our way through various components to that. We got about 35 minutes, so we'll work our way through. But really, if you want a marriage beyond your wildest dreams, it's all going to find its root right here. So follow along. I'm going to read verse 21 and following, so work with me here. All right, it says, submit to one another out of reverence. Wives, submit to your own husbands as you do to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body, of which he is the Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Husbands, on the other hand, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In this way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated their own body, but they feed and care for their body just as Christ does the church. For we are members of his body. For this reason, a man will leave his father and his mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. this is a profound mystery. But I'm talking about Christ and the church. However, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. All right, let me give you four observations that come to the surface immediately about husbands and wives, men and women. Just four observations out of this passage that I think set a good foundation for us. And the first observation is this, is that men and women are different. All right, you may not have noticed this. You know, men and women are different. You can't read through this passage without becoming aware that he's really speaking. Let me talk to you women first, you wives. Let me talk to you husbands. You know, if it wasn't that we were different, it would just be, okay, all you married people. But right off the bat, you pick up that every one of us is different. At the very last verse he uses, he basically says, wives, what your husband needs is respect. Men have this innate need for significance. We need to be important. We need to be, we need to kind of be respected. But he doesn't say respect wives. He turns and says, husbands, you need to love your wives. Women have this innate need for security, for intimacy, for connection. That what we need, what gives energy to our souls is different for men and women. Now, granted, men need love, women need respect, but what drives us is a little bit different. And so what he's really saying, and look, do not forget for a moment that you have married an alien. You married somebody from a different planet. You know, years ago, some guy wrote a book called Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. Why did he do that? Because we're just so different. We don't do anything the same. If we were going to, instead of going online to buy a pair of pants, and a husband and wife were to go out to buy a pair of pants at the Gap or Target or wherever, would they do it the same way? No, a man would walk into the store, he'd go straight to the pants, he'd grab a pair of pants, he'd walk out the store and be done. The woman is going to search the store. She's going to search, she's going to be in the grocery section. She's going to be over here. She's going to try all of the pants. She's going to hold all the pants. She's going to ask the other woman, how do these pants make me look? You know, and all that stuff. And there, it's going to be an all-day affair. We're just different. We're just different. You know, and all you have to do, honestly, is to look at our physical makeup. Do we look the same? Well, duh. Does it make any sense that our internals would be the same? No. First observation, men and women are different. Second observation, men and women are equal. Equal. There is no priority in this passage. Men and women, husbands and wives, have exactly the same value in the eyes of God. Both of them are equal before the Lord. Jesus died for both of them to the same degree. And as you read this passage, there is no hint that one is more important or better than the other. Right? And verse 21, when he says, submit to one another, puts us all on equal footing. Everything said here flows out of this command to submit your resources, what you have, to the needs of the other. That all of us for a good marriage enter in going, you know, you are, and frankly, it's that Philippians 2 idea of, I'm going to treat you as if you're more important than I am, and yet we are equal. There is no superiority, which is always what gets us in trouble culturally, when we begin to believe that one gender is more superior than the other. We're different, but we're equal. Third observation is that men and women are not interchangeable. You know, we're simply not interchangeable. This is not a plug and play. We are of equal value, but we are not homogenous. Men and women are not, it's like so many light bulbs or chairs where we're all the same and you can swap them in and out. That God has created us different as men and women, as husbands and wives, to teach us. It tells us that God has done this to teach us some very hidden things about God. That there is this incredible mystery about the makeup of God that can only be understood by men and women, husbands and wives, doing this thing together. And that's why when he says one of the great functions of marriage is to teach us this mystery of Christ and the church. And Christ and the church are not interchangeable, right? They're different. Which leads to the fourth, I think, and that men and women are absolutely necessary. I mean, there is this reality. When Paul takes us back to Genesis 2, when he quotes Genesis 2 here in the middle of the passage, you know, in verse 31, he takes us back to this day when the first time he ever spoke that creation wasn't good, and he says, it is not good for the man to be alone. It is not good for the man to be alone. There needs to be this community, that this necessity of the male and the female are they are necessary to both be there. Back in Genesis 1:26, it says this. It says, then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they, man and woman, may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over the livestock and all the wild animals and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. We are both in his image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. So there's this difference, but necessity. Now, this has a ton to say about marriage, right? But it also has a ton to say about the church. It's why the church, why small groups, why the family of faith is so important. It's why we really cannot understand the full will of God nor the full character of God as only men or only women. They are both completely necessary. Now this is not a statement. Let me pause here for a moment and kind of do a sidebar. This is not a statement that it is bad to be single. Matter of fact, when you go back through history, Christianity is really the first religion that held up single adulthood as a viable way of life. Jesus was single. As far as we know, Paul was single. Of course, all the snarky guys love to say that he does talk about the thorn in his flesh, and that might have been his wife, you know, but probably not, you know. But Paul says that it is a blessing to be single because, frankly, you're not distracted by the rest of life. Being married is a distraction to following the Lord because you're giving energy to something other than him. So it's not a bad thing. Neither one of them are good or better. They just are. So this is not a statement that somehow you need to be married or must be married in order to be. It's really a statement that it requires all of us in the church, in small groups, men and women, in order for us to see who God is. We are both necessary and critical to the dominion work we have in the world. All right? Now, as you read through this passage, there are three simple commands. All right? We gave you four kind of observations. Let me just remind you the three simple commands. When Paul speaks, he says this. In verse 21, he speaks to all Christians, and he basically says, submit to one another. And when he says that, what he means is that you have resources. God has resourced you. You have who you are. And to submit to someone else is to take all that you are and to come up underneath their need and to lift them up. That's really what submission is. Submission is not that somebody else puts their thumb on you, kind of the Rolling Stones under my thumb. That is not at all what it is. It's the idea that you come up underneath, you bring all that you are to the needs of someone else, and you lift them up. Okay, that's submission. So he says, number one, Christian, all you Christians, all you husbands and wives, the foundation is you submit yourself to their needs. Then he turns to the wives, and in verse 22, he says, submit to your husbands. We'll come back to that in a minute. And then he says to husbands, sacrificially love your wives. Okay? Now, men, before we walk away and move any further in this, there's something I want you to notice. In this passage, six different times he turns to the men, he turns to the husbands, and six different times he repeats over and over again, love your wives. Love your wives. Love your wives. And he repeats it over and over and over so that we will begin to get this, right? But so often when preachers come to this, when men come to this, what they see is when he says, lead your wives. But I'm going to tell you, three times as often he says, love your wives. His primary concern is that you love your wives like Jesus loved you. And then out of that, you lead your wives. You know, back in the first century, it was scandalous to turn to the husbands, to turn to their wife, to these men and say, lay down your life for your wife. That was scandalous. It was assumed that the man would rule his home as his kingdom. The woman was no more than a possession that he had. She was no different than a slave or an ox. So when Paul comes along, when Jesus comes along and says, men, we're changing this game. From now on, you are to submit yourself to come up underneath her and lift her up in love. That was scandalous. It made the church stand out. When it says wives submit to your husbands, that was just assumed. That was the cultural norm. It was just assumed that wives would submit. Why? They were no greater than a slave. But to turn to the men, and this is why I think there's so much more written to men here than women, to turn to the man and say, we're going to change the rules on how you operate, and from here on out, you are going to humble yourself like Jesus did, and you are going to serve your wife in love from here on out. See, today, I think our culture has flipped this, and it's just assumed that husbands will love their wives, and it is scandalous to suggest that wives would submit themselves in any way to a man. Culture doesn't like it either way. But see, the commands are pretty straightforward. All of you guys, you serve each other. You submit to one another. Wives, submit to your husbands. Now let's work this thing out a little bit. Let's talk about the primary roles that he's laying out here. For husbands, the primary role is that of a servant leader. Right? That's really what he's saying. And you get this by combining the two things you see in the passage, that like Jesus, we give ourselves up for our wives. That's the servant side. In verse 23, husbands are the head of the wife or the head of the family, and so he becomes the servant leader. That does not mean, men, that you become the boss. It does not mean that you become the tyrant. Husbands, you are to be the servant who leads his wife. And now there are two sides to this, obviously. There's the serving side and there's the leading side. And we love by laying our lives down. And so there's this role to protect and to care for the wives that we have. And these two tensions of servant leader have to be held, these two sides have to be held in perfect tension at all times. You must have both. And husbands, we have a tendency to swing to one side or the other. We either become servants or we become leaders, right? We either become servants without any real strength of leadership, or we become leaders that has no real serving, laying our lives down. And so there is a mix here of both tough and tender that God is calling a man to be. See, if it's only the leadership side, if we only focus on that, being the head of the house, this is what leads to being abusive and chauvinistic and tyrants in the home, right? If we only swing over here, and so you can swing into this kind of hyper-masculinity type thing. But see, and if you swing to the other side of this deal, you kind of become weak and you become passive. You're just serving, and there's no strength in your leadership, no strength in your serving. And so it's really both sides of these things that we have. And remember, he basically says you're going to love like Jesus loved. You're going to be willing to die for your wife. All right, so wives, let me talk about your role a little bit. What does he lay out here? What he says is that the wives, and I don't really care for the wording, and I'll tell you why in a minute, but you are the strong helper, right? And so you're the submitter, but that does not mean you become a doormat to be walked on and run over. It means that you bring all your resources and your strength, which God has given you a ton of. All your abilities, that you bring that up under the needs of someone else. And it's not to be coerced, it's not to be some kind of forced submission, but a chosen submission that you choose to lay down your life. Now, again, let's take this thing back to Genesis 2 for just a minute, because Paul takes us there in the passage and reminds us of this. You know, in Genesis 2, you know, it says that the Lord said, it is not good for the man to be alone. He says, I will make a helper suitable for him. Okay, none of us like this word helper. It, it, It's an accurate translation. Unfortunately, it has all kinds of cultural baggage. Because when you think helper, what you think is someone who is weak. Let me try to redeem this word a little bit this morning. In our world, in our culture, a helper is an assistant. If you say to your little child, "Aren't you mommy's little helper?" What are you saying? What you're saying is he's less than the real deal. He's, you know, if you're a carpenter's helper, well, you're a gopher. You get paid less, you're less important, and all of that kind of stuff. But that's kind of, but when you come to the scriptures, to this word helper, it's the Hebrew word azer. When you track down this idea in the Hebrew of azer, if you follow it through the Old Testament, you know where you end up? You end up with God. The primary being who is referred to as helper in the Old Testament is God. You start tracking down all of the passage, and so when it tells us that God is our helper, it's not that he's less than, he's our gopher. What it means is that he is someone who is able to supply what is lacking in us. He has the resources to move into the areas that we don't have it, where we lack, right? And so the idea of helper, I don't like the word. We kind of stuck with it. I've been using it for years and years and years. I love the idea of partner, but that's been compromised in our culture as well. And so really, if you simple it down, it means this, is that wives, as a helper, is that you fill the gaps in your husband. And it doesn't take real long to figure out he's got gaps, does it? Right? You know, it sounds judgmental. No, it's just a fact. I mean, it's just a reality. I mean, I've always loved it since back in the 70s when I saw the very first Rocky movie. I know we're up to like 42 or whatever now, but in the very first Rocky movie, Rocky turns to Adrian, right? The gal, "Oh, Adrian," says, "I got gaps and you got gaps and together we got no gaps." That is excellent theology. That's exactly what God is saying here, is that women, wives, you move into a marriage because the man you've got's got all kinds of holes. He's got all kinds of weaknesses. And God has handpicked you to be the one to come along and to fill those gaps. The dilemma is men do not like to admit that they have gaps. We try to hide all of our gaps. But men, we cannot do this thing alone. We cannot, and that's why God looks at Adam and goes, "Yeah, perfect environment, everything's wonderful, there's no sin in the world, but this is not good. No bueno that you have nobody to help you." And so wives, you're the strong helper because you bring a world of resources into this marriage that are designed to meet the needs of the fellow that you've got there. Now again, we could swing to either extreme. You could become strong or you could become a helper. And you could swing to hyper-femininity. Or you could reject femininity, right? You could become controlling or you could become weak. You could try to take over and be the boss of the marriage or you could become a doormat. Neither one of those extremes is what God's called you to be. It is a strength that you bring to fill the holes in your man. Does that make sense? All right, now, husbands, let me get real direct on what all this looks like, all right? So your job is to love like Christ loves. So how did Jesus love us? It's not complicated, is it? Let's work our way through this. First is I got to take the first steps. Jesus took the steps to come to us, right? He didn't wait for us to get it together. He didn't wait for us to take the first steps. Jesus initiated. He entered our world. He came to us. He is Emmanuel. We're moving into the Christmas season. We're celebrating the fact that he entered our world. And husbands, you have to enter the world, the life of your wife. You have to move towards her. You have to take the first steps in building the relationship. You have to take the first steps in resolving conflict. You have to take the first steps in getting to know her. You have to be the one to move first. If there's some big fight that goes on in the family and you have some conflict and you are going to sit back here and say, No, you can't sit and wait. It's up to you to begin to resolve the problem in the marriage. You got to take that first step. You got to make the move. You got to go to work on this thing. If there are hard decisions to be made, yeah, you got to take the first step. If you need to take some steps in your relationship, don't sit around waiting for your wife to nag on you. It's on you. You take that first step. So the first thing, like Jesus, we take the first step. We take the first step in serving her. Secondly, just like Jesus, I got to lay aside my comforts for her. Jesus left the comfort of heaven and entered into a sinful world. He gave it up for us. And that means, men, you got to get out of your comfort zone. I know you guys. You do not want to talk about feelings. Right? You don't even want to talk. You talked at work. You come home, it's like, I don't want to talk anymore. But you come home and she wants to talk. You want to watch SportsCenter. Right? You want to retreat. But what you got to do is lay aside what makes you comfortable for her comfort. You got to get into her world. You don't have to become like her. You must enter into that world. You got to lay aside your own comfort for her. Third, it kind of flows out of that, is I got to put her needs above my own. Right? I got to sacrifice for her. And my first thought, when you wake up in the morning, your first thought has to be, what does she need from me today? How can I help? What can I do? How can I serve her? And whatever that may be, I mean, if you start your day getting up going, what can I do to serve you today? Let me assure you, both the issues in your marriage are going to go away. Right? You don't need a ton of reassurance that you're loved, but she does. She's got her own love language. You got to go figure that out. I know women speak a language we don't understand, but there are courses on this that will help you translate it. So you got to do this thing. Right? And then finally, men, husbands, you've got to love God first and foremost. That's really what the passage is saying as well, is that you're going to follow Jesus. You're going to put Jesus first place in your life. And all of the stuff we're talking about for husbands, you know, taking the first step, you know, entering her, these are uncomfortable. They are counterintuitive. And you cannot do it apart from God at work in your life. You don't have the resources. You don't have the smarts. And so you've got to put the Lord up here first. And so, because husbands, God is calling you to give way more than you get. Because that's what Jesus did. You know, he loved us when he was getting nothing back but a beating. He loved us when we wanted to nail him to the cross. And so your job, husbands, your job is, your job is to mirror Jesus to your wife. Matter of fact, you are to be little J Jesus to your wife. That's what he's calling you to be. Okay, so wives, what about you? Paul makes it clear. Submit as unto Christ. Submit as unto Christ. God is calling you to submit to your husband. And we know the abuses that have taken place through this over the years. We know that men have used that to women to make them do whatever they wanted to do. That's not what it is, so let's be careful here. But number one, what I think he's saying here to wives is you got to give your all. I got to give my husband my all. That's what submission to Christ is, right? Isn't it? Is I'm giving Christ all that I am. You have amazing resources, wives. God has blessed you with all kinds of strength and mind and wisdom and compassion. You got to bring that into the marriage. You bring all that you are into this marriage. You don't hold anything back. Because that's what Jesus did. Second, and this is where it gets a little funky, you got to trust his character. We'll talk about that. And what I mean by that, I think, is really simple. I think you just got to believe the best in him. At the end of verse 33, look at verse 33 just for a second. And I want you to see this. We'll kind of, it says, however, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself. And the wife must respect her husband. If I'm going to do a little Malcolm Amplified version here, I think what Paul is saying is this, is wives, or husbands, you need to love your wife even when she's unlovable. Especially when she's unlovable. Because isn't that what Jesus did? Loved us when we were unlovable. And then he turns to the wives and says, wives, you need to respect your wife. Your husband, in an unconditional, even if they're not necessarily doing everything exactly right. Why? Because they have dignity. Why does Jesus love us the way he loves us? Because we have dignity. We have value. We are an image bearer. We're tainted. We're marred, yes. But somewhere in here, wives, you have to believe the best in the man that God has placed you in your life. Does it mean you look past something if it's wrong? Well, of course it does not. But there is an unconditional respect that's not a blind trust that God is calling you to really begin to think highly of the man that God has placed in your life. Because as you do that, they often become that. Third, I think it means to joyfully follow his leadership. That's what we do with Jesus, isn't it? Well, joyfully is that kind of deep-seated down, like, okay, God, I trust you. I'm going to follow you. And then for wives, it's the same as the husbands. So I got to love God first and foremost. So, see, what God is doing in this passage really is he is asking each of us to trust his design that is different from us. We don't know why he designed things the way he did. We don't know exactly why he made men and women the way he did. We know it reflects him in some ways. We don't know why God set the order up in here exactly the way it is. But he is asking us to trust his design, to trust his plan. And that's why Jesus is the model for both the husband and the wife. Jesus is the model for the wife because Jesus lived in complete dependence on the Father and the Spirit for his entire life. He didn't do anything. Jesus lived in submission to the Father his entire life. And whatever God wanted him to do, that's what he did. There was this sense of your will, not mine, within the way Jesus lived. And Jesus is the model for husbands because he laid his life down for his bride. You know, he took the initiative. He died for us. So Jesus' call on us as husbands and wives doesn't make it easy, but it just makes it real of what we've got to be. And so having said that, you know, husbands, this doesn't mean, when you love your wives, it doesn't mean that you give your wife everything that she wants. That's not love. That's enabling. It doesn't mean that your job is to make her happy at all costs. God doesn't do that with us. It's impossible. It doesn't mean that your job is simply to say, yes, dear, whatever you want, dear, as you wish, dear. You know, that's abdicating. But your job is to love her sacrificially. Wives, this doesn't mean that you have to submit or obey your husband even when he's wrong. Biblical submission never looks like that. This is not some blind immediate. It doesn't mean that, wives, you have no voice in what is happening, no role in decisions. It doesn't mean that you are less than. If your husband is doing something that is wrong, then it's your responsibility before the Lord to call that out of him. And it doesn't mean that, wives, listen, it does not mean that you have to submit yourself to abuse or put your kids in danger, ever, ever. Which brings to kind of this observation. Under the curse, our marriages are hindered. But under Christ, our marriages are transformed. Sin is still at work in our world. Under the curse, men, we are drawn to passivity or to dominance, one or the other. Under the curse, women, you are drawn to being either controlling or abdicating. And under the curse, we see the worst in our marriages. But Jesus says that when we walk with him, when we love him, when we put him first, we are transformed. And Jesus is in the process of changing all of our hearts. He's changing what we want, changing our ability to do it. And so under Christ, we have the power to love and to submit ourselves and to lead and to follow and to be the men and the women that God designed us to be. Under Christ, it's no more scorekeeping. It's no more, well, you did, therefore I did. You didn't, therefore I won't. Under Christ, we can find that he fills us up so that we no longer have to demand from our spouse. It seems to me, as I look through this passage, as I reflect on this passage, if I think about where we are in our culture in this time of history, it seems to me that the real battle here is for men to follow Jesus well. You know, I know we get a little weird when we start talking about submission and leadership and headship and all this stuff. But what I see here is this great call on men to follow Jesus well and to lay our lives down well for them. Quite honestly, I don't know that I've ever seen a marriage that really struggles with the wife following as you were or serving with along with the man when the man is following Jesus and laying his life down well. And men, too many of us are letting our wives take the lead spiritually, and we're riding her coattails. Men, too many of us are letting our wives be the spiritual one who brings the spiritual input to our kids, who prays, who initiates, who says, hey, let's get in a small group, hey, let's go to church, and we kind of come grudgingly along when we'd rather be doing something else. When a wife is convinced that her husband is willing to lay his life down for her, the concept of submission never even gets talked about. It's just natural. So again, six times Paul says, men, love your wives. Only a couple of times does he say anything about headship and leadership. So a couple of two final questions, all right? Two final questions. One is, so who does what? Right, that's a huge question these days in terms of role. Who does housework, the dishes, changes diapers, mows the lawn? Who goes to work and who stays home? Who does the driving? You know, who earns the most money? Who stays home from work when the kids are sick? And we get to go on and on. Well, here's the answer. The Bible never says. All these role questions we have today, the Bible didn't say anything. There's no real clear indication about how that works, the marital dance works. There's a mess of freedom in the details. What we must be careful of here is inserting our culture into our marriage that is not there. We live in a southern culture where there's still a whole lot of kind of this idea of men do all the driving or the working and all of this stuff, but it's not a biblical concept. So we've got to be really well aware of what's cultural, what our family did, versus what it says in the Bible. There is no statement in the Bible of who writes the checks. There is no statement in the Bible of who cleans the house. These are all roles that the husbands and wives work out in their dance. One last question. What if I'm married to a, and you get to fill in the blank, right? A jerk or a shrew or a tyrant or a nagger or a wimp or a witch with a B, whatever it is you want to put in here, right? What if I'm married to that person? What if you're the only one in your marriage who wants to get it right? Let me get some thoughts. Number one is, first, you're the only person you can control. Okay? You have to do your part as unto Christ. That's really what he's saying here. There's no statement as he looks at the husbands and wives that the others are married to people who are doing it right. Basically saying, if you're going to follow Jesus, this is between you and Jesus. You have to do what Jesus is calling you to do. You have to do your role as unto the Lord, right? And you have to be the very best husband, the very best wife, and leave the results to God. And it's also saying that you can't keep score here. I will do this when he does that. And if he doesn't do that, then I'm not going to do that. And when we get into that kind of scorekeeping, we're dead. Secondly, I think the image of the dance is really helpful here, but because you might be married to a terrible dance partner, right? I don't watch Dancing with the Stars, but some of you do. Every year I hear about, you know, I hear everybody talking, oh, can you believe that Bobby Bones won? He's a terrible dancer, you know, and I hear all this stuff, you know. But there are places you can get dance lessons and get better. We're going to have a workshop in February on marriage. Sign up for it. Husbands, take the initiative. And sign your wife up for this. Don't let her nag you. Do this. A third observation is this. Let me wrap it up here. Abuse and danger are never acceptable. Let me say that again. Okay? Because sometimes a Christian husband who says he's a Christian will hold this over their head saying, oh, God hates divorce. And he'll use that to abuse his wife, for goodness sakes. Abuse and danger are never acceptable. I will tell you this, and I give you tons of examples. If you will commit, both of you, to doing it as Jesus lays it out here, it is never too late. And the longer you do this uncomfortable thing, it becomes a comfortable path that you can walk down. And you can have a good marriage if you're willing to take the steps that he lays out for us here. All right? So trust him to work. Trust him to work. All right. Let me pray for us, you guys. Lord, thank you that you speak so boldly and clearly about marriage.